I suppose from time immemorial, scholars and philosophers, lexicographers have tried to define love without too much success, or without much satisfaction, at least to the rest of us. We're not going to attempt to define it either. But we would observe that one of the difficulties in defining it is the fact that there are different kinds of love. Now, our interest here, and it's related to our theme, love one another, our interest here is, of course, in the scriptural love, the love that is spoken of all through the pages of God's Word. And I think that under the circumstances, we can speak of it as Christian love. And for that reason, our topic is Christian love. And you will understand that it's the love that is spoken of so much through the Bible, particularly by Jesus and his apostles and disciples. No, we're not going to try to define even that, but we are going to attempt to analyze it to some extent. See if we can't learn something more about it. As a start, perhaps we should ask this question of ourselves. To whom should our Christian love be directed? We're not at loss at all for testimony to answer that question. And we're only going to quote a few passages. There are many that we could quote. But first, we would say, and I know you'll agree, that our love should be directed to God. This Christian love is godlike love, because we know that Christ was as one in mind and purpose with his God. And we know that God himself is love, perfect in his love and his mercy and righteousness and all the other virtues that we learn of in his Word. So our first love should be directed to him, as recorded in this part of Luke 10, which our brother read. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy strength and with all thy mind, and thy neighbor as thyself. Now, if we love God, we must love Christ. That's very obvious, because they are as one. And Jesus followed, or obeyed his Father, rather, in all respects. But next to them comes, I think, in the order of importance, the brethren. And our theme, we've already mentioned, is here at the Bible School, is love one another. And if you will or if you're familiar with John 15, 17th verse, where that occurs, you will see that it is directed to, that command was directed to the brethren. But there are other places too, in John the 13th chapter, 35th verse. Love one another as I have loved you, Jesus declared to his disciples, indicating that this was towards the brethren, towards his disciples, his servants, which means the brethren of Christ. Love one another with pure heart fervently, the Apostle Paul declares in Colossians. And on the negative side, he that hateth his brother abideth in death, as stated in 1 John. And then we have the Apostle Paul's exhortation in Romans, the 12th chapter, 10th verse, to be kindly affectioned one with another. I think that's sufficient to show that we should practice Christian love on or with our brethren. Next, not necessarily next in importance, but in addition to God and to Christ and the brethren, we must love our neighbor. And that is clearly taught right in this parable of the Good Samaritan that our brother Howes just read. I don't think we need to read it again. But as this text is stated, the important thing was to love God, and next in importance was to love thy neighbor. And, of course, our neighbor would include our brethren, naturally. Now, those really are not two separate commands, because if we love God, we will very naturally love our neighbor and our brethren. And we cannot love God unless we love our brethren and our neighbor. There's an affinity there, a connection. You've got to accept both. You can't accept one, reject the other. Then the question comes, which this lawyer asked, who is our neighbor? And I think it demonstrates very clearly who our neighbor is. Sure, he is our next door neighbor, the man or the woman that lives on the same street, but he's much more than that. He may be a chance acquaintance. He may be a perfect stranger, as was the case here. And so we can't restrict our neighbors to those who live nearby or those with whom we work. It may be anyone in this wide, wide world that we may come across and for whom we may do a Christian service. Now, in this parable of the Good Samaritan, you'll notice that there is not one word as to whether this person was worthy of the love which was shown him by the Samaritan. The Samaritan didn't go over to him and ask him what his politics were, what his religion was, what his nationality was. He went over and helped the man without bothering, without being concerned with any of those things. So we are not circumscribed in our treatment of our neighbor. It, as I said before, it may be most anyone. It may be a stranger or the person who lives on the same street. It might be a friend or it might be a foe. And I think perhaps the Apostle Paul in Galatians 6, chapter 10th verse, I think states it or helps us to understand this when he says, as we therefore have opportunity, let us do good unto all men. As we have opportunity, let us do good unto all men, regardless of who they may be, and particularly they of the household. That's why I said a few moments ago that it's very important to love those in the household. But if we must do good unto all men, well, that would include, as I said a moment ago, our foes, our enemies, if we have any. Our enemies? We must love our enemies? Yes, even they. That's clearly taught, as you know as well as I, in Matthew, the 5th chapter, in the 43rd, 44th verses, in Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. He said, ye have heard it said that thou shalt love thy neighbor. That's reasonably easy, particularly if they're good neighbors. And hate thine enemy. But I say, Jesus speaking, I say, love your enemies. That's a hard thing to do. But Jesus has commanded it, to love even your enemies. Bless them that curse you, and pray for them that despitefully use you. And that just about wraps it up, to include everybody. But from the testimony that we have given, the neighbor is anyone that we happen to be able to do service, to do a service, even though it may be an enemy. There are no distinctions. So now I think we have found out to whom we should direct our Christian love. But we have yet to find out what Christian love is. Christian love is composed of many elements. And I think we might do well to compare Christian love to a rare or precious stone, jewel, or gem, whatever name you wish to call it. And if our Christian love is perfect, we then become a perfect jewel. Now, there has never been any such, with the exception of Christ, who was obedient in all things, who demonstrated perfectly Christian love, named after himself because of his obedience and his righteousness. But imperfect as we may be, we are reminded that God speaks of his servants as jewels. In the future, at least, he speaks of the time when, in that day, the day of the kingdom, the day of the judgment, in that day when I make up my jewels, speaking of those faithful servants of his who will be rewarded with everlasting life. And his servants also in Isaiah are spoken of as being precious. I will make a man more precious than fine gold. So I think we are at perfect liberty to use a jewel to represent the faithful follower of Christ. And the faithful follower of Christ will exercise Christian love on all those with whom he comes in contact. Now, and you probably know this, most of you at least, know that a jewel or a gem's value is determined not necessarily by its size, although that is a factor, but is determined by the absence of flaws in it, flaws or impurities. And also its value is determined by the symmetry and the uniformity of its facets, the facets being the many faces. That's where the word comes from, faces or facets of a gem. And most of you are perfectly familiar with what the facets of a gem are. If you were to look at a diamond, for example, you can see it with your naked eye, but if you were to be much more apparent under a magnifying glass, you would see that the jewel is made up of very many different faces or facets, different surfaces, and as you turn that, each one will reflect the light. So, a gem's value, again, is determined by its absence of flaws or impurities, and the degree of accuracy with which the faces or facets have been cut, the degree of uniformity of one facet to another. It might help us a little bit if we produce now this shot. On here, I have at the top, as you will notice, Christian love. And on one side, I have its elements. And on the other side, its flaws. Now, you could make up a list that might be somewhat different. Certainly, I don't pretend that this includes all the flaws or all the elements. And we're going to talk very little about these. We're going to talk more about these three items on which I have a question mark. But let's consider these, this group here and that group first. First, we'll take the negative, approach it negatively, to discuss the flaws that may be found in this jewel of which we speak. I think that this whole group here will readily be recognized and not debatable, readily recognized as being clearly shown as flaws in Christian love from the scriptures. The general tenor of all the scriptures will tell us that these things are wrong: hatred, cruelty, unkindness, selfishness, anger, arrogance, thoughtlessness, impatience, envy, pride, jealousy, strife, untruthfulness. The general tenor of the scriptures teaches that throughout. Specifically, you'll find a great deal of information in 1 Corinthians, the 13th chapter, what we call the love chapter. And I would call attention to those who do not know it, that while the Oxford version uses the word charity, the Diaglot and the Revised Version both use the word love more correctly. Also, in the Sermon on the Mount, in Galatians, the 5th chapter, and in Ephesians, the 4th and 5th chapters. You'll find much in there to prove what I have just said. But again, let me point out that the general tenor of the scriptures teaches the same thing. So because these are self-evident, I don't think we need spend any more time on them. And we'll mark them self-evident and now go on to something else. Now, up here, here's the first item that we've raised a question on. And I imagine many of you have. You're wondering what it's doing up there. We had a brother for many years in Worcester. Many of you knew him, Brother Alex Bruce. And he often spoke, as most brethren do, on Christian love. I don't think he ever talked on the subject without prefacing his remark by saying that Christian love is not that romantic feeling that exists between boy and girl or between husband and wife. Well, I considered it, as a matter of fact, whether to include this, but remembering that, I think we might include it as a flaw. But you will say, well, there's nothing the matter with love between the sexes. Most of us have experienced it. That is true. But it is sometimes a very unsettling condition to be in. And it is sometimes selfish. Not always. Not always. And speaking of selfishness, you will recall that the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians, 7th chapter, 32nd, 33rd verses, makes the comment that there is danger when people marry that they will be so concerned with pleasing each other that they may neglect their responsibilities to God or their responsibilities as servants of God. There is that danger, which has happened. I think perhaps we've all seen or known of such examples. It isn't always so. And then the other reason that I've already mentioned, this matter of at least, shall we say, temporary insanity that strikes people, and perhaps ourselves, in our younger years. There are periods, you know, in this condition of romantic love where we may be extremely upset emotionally and unstable, independable. When we're separated from reality, we often hear the expression, he or she is walking with their heads in the clouds, or they're walking on air. That isn't permanent, usually, but it is oftentimes a fact. Now, after you get over that stage, perhaps that could be crossed out. But at one period in the lives of many of us, that has occurred. And at the risk of seeming too facetious, I'd like to quote a little verse that an aunt of mine, again, some of you knew years ago, Sister Lena Holmes from Worcester, a little verse that she used to quote with considerable smug satisfaction because she herself never married. And this is it. What a wondrous thing is love. It cometh from above and lighteth like a dove on some. And some it never hits except to give them fits and scatter all their wits, our home. Now, I wouldn't laugh because it's pretty serious while that condition lasts, but fortunately, it is not permanent. But when a person is in that condition, it can be a flaw in our Christian makeup. So, I think we can check that off. We say, again, that perhaps it shouldn't have been there at all, but again, I think it oftentimes is a flaw, at least temporarily. And even though we get over this period of instability, it can continue to be a very selfish love for one's mate to the detriment of our service to God. Now, let's turn to the more positive, to the positive side. We've not got rid of them, but we have, I think, covered the flaws. These are things that we don't want in this jewel, which is ourselves. Over here, these are the elements. These are the things that go to make up a jewel. And we will deal first with this book of elements. And I think you will all recognize, without any debate, without any discussion, that these things are taught in the scriptures and are necessary in the true Christian's makeup. Affection, mercy, kindness, generosity, meekness, humility, thoughtfulness, long-suffering, self-sacrifice, gentleness, sympathy, compassion, justice, truthfulness. I notice one already that I perhaps should have had in there, patience, and there are others too. However, these are representative. They don't intend to be a complete list any more than do these. And for the same reason that we said little about this, we will also say little about these. These two, I think, will be recognized as self-evident to anyone who is familiar with the scriptures. And the same scriptures that teach that these are flaws also teach that these are desirable elements. The Sermon on the Mount, the 5th of Galatians, the 5th and 6th of Ephesians, and the 1 Corinthians 13 specifically, but again, they are taught generally through the whole scripture. Now, we come down to the last two, and that is where we may have a difference of opinion. We may think that, well, what if chastening and rebuke got to do with love? I think we can prove that they have something to do with Christian love. We've already said that Jesus was perfect in all his ways. And I don't think we said it, but we know that we should emulate him. We should try to copy him in everything that he did. That is, copy him in his ways, in his virtues, in his walk. And if you will recall that there were several occasions when he, who was perfect, mind you, when he used chastening and rebuke, or discipline perhaps is another synonym. We think of the corruptors of the temple whom he drove out. Now, those were his enemies. They had nothing to do with him. They wanted nothing to do with him. They were his enemies. But because he practiced what he preached and loved his enemies, he must have loved them, and yet he drove them out of the temple. That, I think, is an example of where chastening is permissible and was used by Christ, our example. That doesn't mean that we can chase thieves out of our homes or out of our place of business or out of anywhere. But it demonstrates, not necessarily the driving out of thieves, but it does demonstrate the sometimes necessity for chastening. But let us consider something within our own experience. Let us consider, for example, the subject of corporal punishment. Consider it in relation to our children, or perhaps consider it in relation to our parents years ago. Now, the scriptures say to bring up a child in the way that it should go. And that was expressed, I believe, by Solomon, who was one of the wisest men that ever lived. And Solomon also said, you spare the rod and spoil the child. Of course, that doesn't mean to beat them. But the little darlings sometimes do need chastisement of a sort. A little slap at the right time, the right place, is often necessary and also very effective if it is done at the right time. The timing is rather important. However, we're not going to get into a discussion of child psychology. But when that happens, you may have said it to your parents, or you may have had it said to you by your children. It has often been said, when a child is punished, the child has often said, "You don't love me anymore." Is that true? Of course it's not. Of course it's not. And oftentimes the child gets to learn that it's not true. How many times have children, after having been punished and cooled off, and their hurt feelings healed, will come back to their mother or father and want to love them, want affection? It often happens. I think you will agree. So they come to learn that their parents do love them. In that connection, you will all recall the time-honored joke or cartoon, or joke as expressed in cartoons, and you see it in the comics. I've seen it since I was a little boy, and that's a long time ago, and you all have seen it. The father, or might be a mother, spanking his child. We'll say it's a boy, because the boys generally need more spanking than the girls. And the father says, "This hurts me more than you." Well, do you believe it? The child don't believe it. Well, of course, the parent is not hurt in the physical sense, because his hand is much tougher than that part of the anatomy that the child whom he is striking. But he is hurt. It hurts him mentally. It hurts him in mind and in heart, that he must discipline, that he must chastise, that he must hurt physically this child that he loves. So it isn't a joke, really. We make a joke out of it, but it's not. It actually does. A good parent who loves his children will suffer more than that child when chastisement is necessary. And I think that's a good demonstration of the fact, as the natural, you know, so is the spiritual. It's a good demonstration of the fact that even though we love a person, sometimes chastisement or discipline of some sort is necessary. I don't necessarily mean corporal punishment. It's just a principle established that disciplining is sometimes necessary to those or toward those whom we love. I was very interested in recent weeks. The Worcester papers have been running a series of articles where teenagers have been, am I allowed to use that expression? We'll say the young folks have been interviewed by reporters to get their views on various subjects. It's surprising to have a majority of these young folks report that they felt their parents were not strict enough disciplinarians, that they felt they got away with too much from their children, from their parents. A very interesting comment in these days when we have the serious problem of juvenile delinquency, and I think it's an indictment on the parents. As I said before, it don't mean we have to beat them, but it does mean that we must exercise our discipline, sometimes administered corporally, on our youngsters. A fact that we, like Christa Dolphins, like anyone else, can forget. Now, on this idea of rebuke, I think we only need to give one or two examples. Perhaps the one that first comes to our mind is that of Peter. This was mentioned, I think, in one of our classes. You know that Peter grew to be one of the greatest of the apostles. We don't try to compare one necessarily against the other, but for myself, I would place them right up the top near the Apostle Paul and perhaps James and John. But there was a time when he was rebuked very severely by his master, by Jesus. And that was the time when Jesus was in the 8th chapter of Mark, if anyone wants to know where it's from. That was the time when Jesus was telling his disciples that he must suffer. He must suffer sacrificial death. And Peter objected very strenuously. He wasn't going to allow it. And Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Get thee behind me, Satan, for thou savorest not the things that be of God, but the things that be of men." That's pretty severe language. "Get behind me, Satan. Thou savorest not the things that be of God, but the things that be of men." Now again, it illustrates, and let us not forget that Jesus was perfect in his love for God and for all his fellows. It illustrates or demonstrates very thoroughly, I think, the necessity sometimes for rebuke. The trouble is, we don't always use our judgment, haven't the knowledge and wisdom necessary to know when to chasten or when to rebuke. But the principle, I think, is firmly established that rebuke is sometimes necessary for those whom we love. Now we'd like to refer back again to Galatians 6:10, where we are told to do good unto all men. Now perhaps the mistake that we sometimes make is that we consider this good that we're supposed to do, we consider rather it as the word please, to please all men. But that isn't the way it reads. We can do good to our fellow man and may not please them in so doing. And we may please them and yet not be doing good to them. But the scripture says to do good to them. But let's use an illustration. It's rather an extreme one, but it may be one that we have experienced. I have. We like on the street. Panhandler. He may be the worst for liquor, and he wants you to buy him a drink. Now, if we were to please that man, we would do what he said, but it wouldn't be good for him. Do we do that? Do we buy him a drink? No. We do what's good for him, not what he wants. We may make some efforts to straighten him out, but we certainly do not buy him the liquor that he craves. As with the precocious child, and as with Peter, as with the derelict, what is required of us is love, and love composed of these elements here. See what chastening and rebuke does for the precocious child, and see what it did for Peter. It was after Peter was rebuked that he grew in such spiritual stature as to be one of the great disciples. And see what it does for children within limits, within the bounds of Christian love. Disciplining the children teaches them to grow up in the way that they should go, and it teaches them self-discipline and Christian behavior. Now, in conclusion, a precious stone is imperfect for several reasons. If foreign particles or flaws exist in it, or if any of these elements are missing, and there are other elements too that I have not put on the board, if any of the Christian virtues, which we are calling elements, are missing, the stone is imperfect. Or, and this is quite important, I think, if the facets or the faces of the gem are not truly cut and uniform. In this latter respect, we would say that uniformity or balance is essential. For example, affection is very important. I haven't, by the way, tried to list these, and they're all important, because I don't think it's possible. But affection is very important. But we can be so affectionate or affectionately inclined towards others, or some one individual perhaps, that some of the other elements suffer by comparison. For instance, we may be so affectionate towards someone that we lack justice. We lack justice. We might spoil them, in other words. We might have so much affection for our children that we forget or ignore the chastening or the justice of a situation. And they grow up spoiled. That's one illustration. In excessive kindness, which is akin to affection, we may hesitate to rebuke when rebuke is necessary or called for. Or we may hesitate to discipline when discipline is necessary. We do others no good if we do not practice all the Christian virtues or elements. In other words, if we are not in balance. Christian love is not doing, and we repeat, is not doing what another wants necessarily, but it is doing to them or for them that which is good for them, that which is good for them in the spiritual sense. They may not always like it. They may think that they are unloved as a chastened child, but they may come to learn, like the child and like Peter, that it is the exercise of true Christian love. Now, I said I wasn't going to try to define Christian love, but perhaps we could briefly summarize this way, that Christian love is the practice of all the virtues that were so very manifest in the whole life of Jesus Christ, our Lord.